Welcome back to another week of the Geek Whisperers. I'm Amy Lewis.
I'm Matt Brender.
And I'm John Mark Troyer.
We are talking about a little bit of a David and Goliath thing today. So we were tossed around different show ideas, and all of us have worked at large companies and small companies. And so we actually kind of all disagree on a number of points this week, which should be exciting, about the pros and cons of influence based on company size. So I guess the question, we got a lot of questions.
You have a kind of a low bar for excitement, I think. I mean, it'll be interesting. I'm all for interesting, but I'm not sure we're actually going to get too exciting today.
Fair point, John. I live a wild and woolly life. What can I say? Yeah, so the pros and cons of influence, and both being if you're running an influence marketing program within a company or if you are an influencer. Going to throw spitball a few things out there and see where we agree, where we disagree.
Take us away, Amy.
Sure. Well, one hypothesis I have is one of the cool things about influence marketing is if you talk about marketing as earned, owned, and paid, then influence marketing is to a great extent earned. Now, admittedly, you know, the channels you can own are greater with a company of greater size and more funding and maybe more brand swagger, for lack of a better word for it. And the amount you can pay would be greater. But I think that influence marketing is earned and therefore more of a meritocracy. So it levels the playing field a bit because everybody can earn influence by doing some things. Go.
Okay. True in theory. So what's the playback to our theme here?
Well, meaning that if it's not necessarily always an extreme advantage to have a large company, that again, just the time back that influence marketing levels the playing field a bit so that company size isn't the differentiator in terms of amount of influence wielded. Hmm.
Okay. So I got a problem with this right off the start. Maybe this is going to be exciting. I did my own startup 15 years ago. And we got up to about 100 people, and we spent about $25 million in an inglorious demise. We had a hard time getting attention. And this was a different era. This was pre-social media. But it felt like I was a very, very tiny mouse yelling, you know, on my Dixie cup, yelling, you know, please, please pay attention to me. And we were at shows. We sponsored shows. We had booths. I spoke at conferences. We did press releases. We got articles written up about us. So we did all that sort of stuff. But it still felt like we were a very tiny, tiny little company and not many people were paying attention. I got to VMware and I wasn't a mouse on a Dixie cup. I was an elephant on a stage. I was an elephant on the Saturn V, man. Everyone wanted to hear what I had to say. So my direct experience at the first pass disputes what you have to say, Amy.
Yeah, I've got a second John's experience on this one, just to not to pile on, but from personal experience that despite having a larger relative voice, when you look at the number of people that have significant social influence at the startup I'm a part of, that relative voice is nice, but it's really more about the overall audience of the product at this stage in order to get people's attention.
Meaning you have a smaller addressable market?
Yeah, smaller addressable market, smaller niche sort of expertise. So we're drawing in a much smaller drip of the overall potential influencer space, meaning that even if you get their attention, they're going to be like, all right, well, that's nice, pat, pat, pat on the head. Like, there are bigger things to argue. So I think the relative influence you could hold from a larger company is kind of multiplied by the amount of available audience.
Now's my time to refute.
Yeah.
Many, many years of debate training has prepared me for this moment. So, John, to your point, and again, absolutely hearing that, and I think that's fair, the size of the megaphone may be true. The size of the total addressable market, like Matt was saying, also true. But, John, your example was in an age before social media and the concept of influence marketing. and maybe even an era of this kind of startup and this kind of, I don't know, incubation. So I think that some of these new tools, and not that any of us think these things are going to set the world on fire or change things, but I think they have expanded our capacity to communicate with one another, and that they have changed what the requirements are to enter the game. So that I think in modern times, that argument, while still true, you can be a bit of a mouse sort of yelling on a Dixie cup, that you have a lot of other tools to amplify your voice, to make it seem that you are, to position yourself as a bigger player in the marketplace, maybe before you are, sort of to set that tone while you catch up and while you expand that total addressable market, so that you're moving that process along more quickly.
Punch above your weight, so to speak.
Absolutely, punch above your weight. Because, again, thinking about the flip side, so going down a little bit of the path of pros and cons. So definitely we can see pro of being with a very large company. If you're either running influence marketing or an influencer, you kind of have the weight of a really large company behind you. But my challenge there is, in a really large company, if you're running influence marketing or you're an influencer, sometimes you have a lot more layers. So you have layers of complexity to execute a campaign, or to be able to write the kind of blogs on your own platform you might want to, et cetera. So there's my other sort of punch in the other direction. I think that people automatically assume you've got this massive amount of funding and weight and expertise, but it means that you have to work differently. You're working across a lot of different organizations. It takes a different approach. So is that, as an influencer or somebody running influence marketing, does that make that harder?
Well, okay, I guess I'll buy it. I don't know, Matt. It definitely lets you punch above your weight. I mean, the famous example is Instagram, which, yeah, again, is a social media company itself, but was like, what, 10 guys or something when they got sold for $1 billion?
That's a great one, yeah.
Docker would be another example. I think they're still pretty small. That's not necessarily because of social media. It's because the technology landscape is in flux right now. I don't know. There's a confluence of a lot of things there.
True, true. But the question I have, and it's hard to go back and scientifically experiment with it, but would we all have heard of those examples? Would we all be sort of in tune with that without some of these tools? And again, to take a story that would have been relatively small, and while the technology need was catching up, or even the Docker example, Instagram, great examples.
I had the same conversation, except it was in 1998, and the topic was websites. Was that true then? Is this true now? I don't know, Matt. What do you think?
I'm still thinking about size of company and influence marketing and the effect of it. And two things that come to mind is that, number one, if you're in marketing in a startup, at least from what I've seen and felt personally, influence marketing is seen as a niche of a niche of some part of social media that you should be doing, which is only 1/10 of your overall job, because you're also alliance partner, creator.
I was just to break in for a slight, I was talking to a company today, and basically they saw it only as a support function. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. They're like, oh, no, that sounds really good, but do 50 other things too. So the idea of, yes, you have more layers to go through in a large company, that is an impediment, but the fact that you have it as a full-time job is unthinkable in startup space. And then the other thing is that when you think of influence marketing and its impact, it tends to be something that is not, and I don't want to talk out of turn here, but it also, it does honestly seem like it's not something that's totally respected up front. It's more about expectations of what you're bringing back to the company. Can these influencers turn into a sale? Can these influencers get us more views on XYZ? Could they give us product feedback that will make us beat the competition? The idea of just the practice itself and aggregating engagement is not as valued as accountable thing as it is in large companies.
Well, I'm going to argue back a little bit on that one, which is If it's going well, I mean, the whole concept, influence marketing isn't supposed to be something that is quite as ephemeral or not measurable. If it's truly influential, if it's truly working, and in some ways, like maybe we define it by the market you're trying to address, if it is more the technical decision maker, if it's the less obvious, not the immediate person who carries the PO, but somebody who works with the person who carries the PO, then if they are truly influential, you should be able to see a difference. And then my argument would be in a small company, you should see the difference more quickly because you are engaging with an audience that is important to your business. And that is different for everyone. This is not a cookie cutter thing. But if you find the right audience and engage them, the whole point is you should be influencing your bottom line. So if you haven't found the right group to engage, you don't have the right group who's influencing.
Well, there isn't exactly a checkbox that says, like, the fact that I know so-and-so is the reason I'm landing on your website. Like, you can do inbound links. Like, so if I personally write a blog post about Infinio and then you click on the link that I had on my webpage and go there, any decent tool will be able to track that inbound link for you and show you how many people click through. But that doesn't tell you that if you and I high-fived in person at VMworld and then we talked on Twitter and then you randomly entered in the URL and then decided to trial it, it doesn't correlate and then say that, oh, influence marketing is successful here.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. Marketo and Salesforce aren't necessarily as much nurturing and MQL and, you know, SQL as they can talk about. They don't necessarily capture... deal with this X factor. Influence marketing in some ways is frustrating, I think, for traditional marketing departments because it does escape the clickable, trackable elements. Yeah. It is the glue between.
Yeah. To talk about X factor for a second, I mean, let's look at what Veeam did in the enterprise backup and recovery space and for small businesses mostly. Okay, so that's interesting. Targeting small businesses, not large, product not super expensive. I mean, one of the reasons I was employed at VMware and the role I was is because VMware products are very expensive and they could afford to pay me a lot of money to hang out with people and do this buzzy thing. Veeam, not the case, right? Small business. They needed high leverage ways of reaching a lot of people and they did a really good job with that X factor. This was back late, 2006, 7, 8, 9. I don't know when they started. But they started reaching out to bloggers and people like that in that era. And the people in the VMware market, because that's the market they were targeting, they did manage to create a buzz. But it was a buzz around a product that everybody liked, at a price point everybody liked, that was easy to try. But I don't know. I think if you had to talk to them, they would tell you that that was a pillar of their story. It didn't mean that they didn't hire a bunch of sales reps and SEs and, you know, webinars up the wazoo. And they're still a very demand gen focused company. But I think that helped them with their X factor starting out.
Yeah, it certainly seems so. And I think anyone that's looking backwards, like our past guest, Carrie Reber, who's VP of marketing at Infinio now, like she was VP of marketing at Veeam and always speaks very highly of this in what we would call now influence marketing campaigns and the hard work that was driving traffic through audience acquisition. But it's one of those things that it seems like you can only paint that picture backwards and not predict it forward, which is fundamentally something that anyone who studied any logic will know that's not something you should trust.
But trust us.
Trust us. Pay me money. I'll be your consultant. And how does the big versus small? You can have a website that looks very professional. You can have a social media presence that looks very professional. One person with that X factor who can have that empathy and that, what do we call it? We don't call it bonding. We call it
rapport.
Rapport. Thank
Trust,
you.
Rapport.
One solid person in that role can make a big difference. I am seeing in the Bay Area a lot of startups having a community manager as one of their first hires or their core team hires because that's how they do marketing. If you look at companies like Lyft or Uber or Airbnb, community managers were actually a very early hire for them because that was an important part of their distribution strategy. Enterprise, we don't really think of it that way,
Well, I think the evangelist role we've talked about, we see rise. You know, we see community managers come in at a certain size, but I think a smaller company often can have an evangelist with the idea that they are armed in that way, and they are meant to punch above their weight, and they are meant to come in already with community ties. So we've talked about career path, why go and engage yourself with a community, because if you come out with community, if you have that sort of gloss and you prove you know how to talk to a particular audience and a potential addressable market, then you have value, high value to a smaller company who's looking to make an investment in an employee that can have a lot of upfront value that comes in kind of fully baked.
Yeah, it seems oddly enough that enterprise companies are willing to spend more on somebody with a big name already and let that be part of their strategy to say, hey, we're bigger than we are. While smaller companies, I really think there's something to what the average sale price is of a given commodity that they're selling. With Lyft, with Uber, these are low-cost products, if you think of it as a product.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Thus, like, the one-to-many scale of community engagement is more and more important.
True, true. Which sort of leads me to my next kind of question. We'll see if we can stir up some more debate here. Does the company size you work for give you influence? Or is influence portable and scalable?
Is there a yes to both option?
Debate away. So yeah. Do you think that you get more influence by working for a larger company that has a bigger revenue run every year? Do you think those folks are on size more influential? Or like I said, you know, does that company size build their influence and then that becomes portable to a company of any size? What are your thoughts there?
I'm going to go a different direction than I initially led. I'm going to say that good influence marketing is reasonably cheap, so company size is less relevant than other factors. And it's certainly the reputation that you build is very portable if you do it well.
We're talking about individuals, though. I mean, so do you think, like, you know, Jane Doe comes out of Super Duper Corp, and is she considered a rock star because Super Duper Corp, you know, has all this funding and can support her? Or is that always bootstrapped? Is that person always a self-made person?
I think people appreciate that these things are always a function of what your role is and what you're doing. No one's self-made in a business where you're being paid to do something, but you can do it in a way that complements the community space, that complements influence marketing really well, or you can do it in a way that's kind of by the books and seemingly a little bit more soulless. So if somebody is really engaged and they're not just setting up the events, but they're at the events and they're getting to know you and you build rapport with them as an individual, I don't care what company they're at. And sometimes I don't even know what company they're at for a while until I connect on LinkedIn. So those things are less important and it's more about that personal relationship, and that's the value. Hmm. What are your thoughts?
I'm going back to the size of the stage. Certainly, if we're going by business people metrics, right? If you're an executive, the bigger the company you're at, the more respect you get. That's the value system that they've got going on. Sometimes it's true, sometimes it's not. They certainly make more money the bigger the company they are at, right? For influence marketing, I think people at very small companies have made very big impacts. So that's interesting. I think there's a lot of very interesting side projects that get interesting. I think especially in the Bay Area, you've got all sorts of crazy ass meetups and weird incubators and side projects and the constant.
Okay, hold up.
Yeah.
I'm calling you out there.
Yeah.
So on the East Coast represent. That's a classic that's a classic David and Goliath of the idea that it all happens in Silicon Valley. And I would argue again that with the new tools that there's an awful lot of people who've made careers, have done interesting things, have connected to interesting projects, who work remotely and not necessarily automatically in a center of technology, or have created a new cadre of technologists around themselves or in an area, partially because they aren't located right there in the center, so they have to work differently. So I totally get your point. There's a lot going on there. But I think in some ways that lends a little bit of flavor and excitement to our argument. Mm-hmm. There is a bit of David and Goliath in terms of geography and location there as well.
Well, Amy, I wasn't saying that the West Coast people were better. I was actually saying that there's in a tech hub like this, there are a lot of side projects and interesting, like, cool people screwing around. And those people can do very influential things. Okay, let's use an East Coast person. There's a guy called Paul Ford. His Twitter handle is FTrain. He was the original webmaster for Harper's Magazine, one of their defining characteristics was they hated the internet. So you can imagine his role as a webmaster was pretty interesting. He's also a writer, and I'll link to something in the show notes. But one of the things he did recently was he actually spun up an old Unix box, or a new Unix box on AWS, and registered a domain name called Tilde Club. And he basically just gave everybody a shell account, and that was all he did, right? And has a web server running. And so everybody gets a little Tilde username, you know, in their URL. So he's not at a big company. He's not doing anything interesting. But all of a sudden you have all these weirdos and people he knows in media and the web world coming together, and they've built all this kind of retro cool, toys. And they just, it's like a fun toy. He's made a playground for nerds by giving them an old shell account, you know? And so that's an example of somebody who, you know, he's not, you know, he doesn't work for AOL or you know, in pushing a giant, you know, media campaign. He doesn't work for Yahoo. He doesn't work for Google. He just did a thing. So I guess from the concept of we live in a world where it's so cheap just to do a thing, you know, start a blog, start a website, spin up some Ruby on Rails app, or start, you know, an influence marketing activity. I guess I'm with you, Amy. I guess small is okay.
All right, I've got one, Matt.
Well, I don't think anyone agreed that small is not okay. It's just a question of whether we're talking about portability still, right?
Yeah, like, we're so corporate, man. Screw all that.
You're going pretty hardcore West Coast right now, my friend.
I haven't cut my hair since I left VMware, man. So I'm letting my freak flag fly.
Oh my god.
Well, so I think a lot of people think of, and this is something we haven't drilled into too much before, and maybe this is even beyond the company size. So I think company size is interesting there. Is influence portable? So can you, like you said, this guy out setting up a shell account, can you take that? Does that make you interesting enough so a big company wants to gobble you up? I mean, we see cases of that, you know? So is influence really a personal thing, or is it you lend your influence to a company? And we've had those debates off and on for a long time about, you know, do people follow logos? Do people follow people? And how much good or harm does where you work do for you? So is your influence your own? If you build it at a small company, I think people go, yeah, it's absolutely yours. If you build it in a large company, I think the default thing is people go, oh, it's the big company behind you.
No, I think you are saying you're biased, which I respect because it's you and I respect you. But I think what you just said is absolutely incorrect, that we talk so much about personal brand and how you are branding yourself in today's world. So maybe the story of what size your company was particularly relevant in the early 90s. But what we've been saying from day one of this show is that if you show up, if you communicate with others and you share publicly and engage, that's yours. And yeah, probably a portion of how much you can influence people is certainly overlapping with the Venn diagram of your company. But if that goes away, you'll have a new company with a new Venn diagram and you'll meet the new people in there because you try harder than others.
I agree with you and want to build on that because, okay, so I think also, Amy, I think you're being much too absolute about this word influence and do you have it or not and does it follow you or not? These things are, it's all time and motion, right? It's all waves. and it's all catching waves, and where that pushes you, it's all catching the right wind on with your sailboat, and reckoning where you're going to be next. I left VMware, and I feel very loved by the VMware community. Okay.
And also, interestingly enough, I feel loved by a Venn diagrams who were not part of the VMware community. When I left VMware, I became safe for people from Microsoft, Citrix, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, who would not follow me before because I was just Mr. VMware. So actually, in some sense, my influence grew. At the same time, I left behind a lot of people who all they do is VMware. And I wasn't tweeting about VMware every day, and I was no longer, you know, I could no longer do them favors from VMware. I was no longer kind of an ombudsman for VMware. So they kind of fell off, and they're not paying attention to me as much anymore. And I have a window of time in which to do something else interesting, or I can just hang out and talk to people too, right? But if I'm going to use that influence to do something interesting, you know, I have a window of time, and it's a wave. So I think this is dynamic, and it ebbs and flows.
The scientist in me, I couldn't resist asking, the meditation koan for the day would be, are you John Mark Troyer because of VMware, or were you always destined to be John Mark Troyer?
Jesus, I don't know.
I caught a wave. It was an interesting opportunity. If I was on dry land, I wouldn't have caught the wave. If I wasn't in the right place at the right time with the right surfboard, I wouldn't have caught the wave. So, I mean, it's both, right? Who moves the surfer?
And I'm thinking about something at my kids' school, which I really like, actually. The new thing in education is not about you're gifted in this or you come in with all this skill. It's effort equals ability. And they have some amazing, if you Google them, and I should find one and get that in the show notes as well, these simple kind of lightning talks about educational theory and about the difference it makes whenever you use this kind of mindset. And our school system is part of it. And the difference it makes, whereas you say, oh, you're fully baked, you're good at this, you're not good at this. But it's just good old-fashioned effort equals ability. So the more you work at it, the harder you work at it, you will build the ability, which is the simplest thing in the world. But I'm watching that in motion and the difference it makes. That's kind of my take on this as well, that if... And Matt, I think you said some phrase like that, if you raise your hand more, if you work a little harder, you do it a little different. And yes, admittedly, there's waves and luck involved a bit there too, but effort will equal ability. If you get up, dress up, show up, and do it over and over and over again, I personally think influence is portable. I think it goes with the person and that it can be, you know, if you have a really negative reputation, you know, it can cast some shade on the company you go to next. If your company has a particularly bad reputation for some reason, I think that can paint you with that brush a bit until you kind of reestablish your own individual credibility. But I think it's that influence and credibility are much more individual than they are the collective. So I think it's portable. Mm.
And to stick to our science theme of tonight, influence really has a half-life to it, on John's metaphor that
nice.
As long it only lasts for so long and then it starts degrading exponentially. And we see that people ebb and flow in their amount of influence based on how much they're showing up, how much they're available to show up. And then they have to earn it back from scratch. And that's a much longer road. But you see this happen all the time.
That's a really good metaphor. I think that's an interesting one. But I think if you have, like you've said before, if you've got influence in a particular area on a certain topic, even if you leave it alone for a long time, when you come back to it, you're still seen as kind of the authority. But you're right. I think for most mere mortals, it is a matter of consistency.
Amy, I've got one. Something to inject here about big versus small.
Okay.
And it's a corollary of the Anna Karenina principle.
Wow. You're all about it tonight.
So the Anna Karenina, you know, if you're familiar with the phrase from Anna Karenina, it says happy families are all alike, but every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way.
Mm.
So you could apply this to many things, but from Tolstoy, big companies are all alike. Small companies are all weird in their own way.
is my corollary. Like, and that goes all the way down to retail, where like you walk into a mom and pop shop and like they're horrible, or you know they're really weird, or small companies can be run by very weird people, right? Whereas big companies, people get kind of hammered into these corporate molds.
It's the McDonald's approach.
Yeah, yeah. McDonald's is never going to be quirky or serve you a new, you know, weird hash brown dish, right?
The McRib is as crazy as they get.
Big at a big company, your influence is kind of, you know, there's some, we've described it. We kind of know how these things run. You know how PR runs. There's an emerging consensus on how social media runs. I don't think we're quite there for influence marketing, but it's getting there. Like, there's an emerging, like, this is how you run it in a big company. It's not always smart, but, you know, and there's crises.
No, I agree.
And
I think it's coming really quickly, ironically. Like, you said that, and it sort of, that resonated with me, that PR and AR and IR have had these traditional ways of going about it for a while. And, you know, there's been evolution that PR has probably been most affected. But with this other, the others, the other group that nobody quite knows what to call, that we're sort of dubbing maybe influencers, mm-hmm. the other IR, it's progressing really quickly. People, the Borg really needs to know where it sits in the org.
and also influence marketing for a Cisco or a VMware or an EMC has to be done in a kind of a certain way, right? There's a corporate personality there. Whereas I would argue that a smaller company, there's a little more freedom. Like Veeam was genuinely quirky back in the day. There's a little more freedom to be quirky, and each company is a little more unusual and has very, you know, different personalities. So can we relate that back to influence? Is it easier to be influential at a small company where perhaps things are quirkier or you have more ability to bring your own personality to bear versus, you know, trying to represent Cisco?
See, I think that's the perfect, this is where I'm going to argue things level out, that sort of system of checks and balances that's wonderfully in place. And because I think at a bigger company, like you said, you have all these more tools at your disposal. You can open doors with a name more so than you can at a small company. You know, you don't have to explain who you are when you say, I work for Cisco. Simultaneously, like you said, there are more constrictions about it because you are carrying the weight of the brand with you. And I think you're spot on in saying the smaller company, you can take a few more chances. You're sort of developing your brand identity. You have more freedom to be a little more quirky individual as you kind of sort your way through that without the quirkiness has yet to be institutionalized. We'll take Shawshank in here as well. I think that those two factors almost end up balancing themselves out. So the freedom you would have to differentiate by being a bit more quirky and a little more loose and freewheeling, you maybe lose some of the simplicity of, you know, a name that opens the door. If this is about individuals, it's interesting. It seems that it's back to effort equals ability. How much energy do you put into it?
I don't know. I hadn't really thought about it. I've thought about it, but I didn't really have an answer for that. So I guess that's as good as any.
Well, no, and one other, you know, sort of thought that was playing out as we start to conclude is I continue to be fascinated by human behavior in groups seems to, like you said, repeat itself. So there are certain things that fall in place when companies are spoken about in these collective nouns because enterprise companies start to behave in similar ways. Mid-sized companies start to behave in certain ways. And even there's uniformity in the quirkiness almost in the startup world. And again, are we locked into our own human condition? So much of marketing, I think, is really people-to-people connection and far more about psychology than I don't know, metrics, technology, et cetera. I'm not even quite sure where I'm going with that point, but it seems that human behavior in groups overreaches whether the company is small or large.
It probably reaches over industries too. You know, my technology consulting practice right now is really in not only in technology companies, but they're in IT infrastructure technology companies, enterprise scale, right? And I've had many conversations with my wife about like, why can't you just go do that for Coca-Cola? Because, you know, again, same kind of behaviors, right? The same kinds of things. So, hey, guys, I got one more thing if you like that last one. Have I told you about my key restaurant church theory?
Well, I'm pretty sure we would have remembered that one, John.
Okay.
Well, was it by Tolstoy?
Yeah, this is not a Tolstoy reference. This one's
a Dostoyevsky, please.
And it relates to big, small companies. And I've actually insulted several people, potential consulting clients, using this metaphor. There are some companies that become part of your life like a church. And VMware was certainly one of them, right? It's a church. You devote your life to it. You hope that you have an afterlife with it. You bet your career on it is the shorthand, right? And you tell people about it. You proselytize. It was very cool when you first saw vMotion. I mean, people really get behind it. Cisco, EMC, all churches, and you have priests, right? There are other companies that I kind of think of more like restaurants, right? You have a good experience. You enjoy them. You might even recommend them to other people. But I don't recommend my local restaurant like I do my church, right? It's like, oh, this is a really nice restaurant, and I really love it. You would enjoy it. You should try it sometime. I enjoyed it. I had a wonderful time. Go there often. And so those are some companies. And then there's like some companies which are like getting a key made. Like, I don't give a shit where I get a key made. Like, I'll get a key. I think the local drugstore makes keys. I don't know. But I don't really care. Like, I'm going to get a key made. It's cost me $1.50. And there are some tools like that. And that might correlate. It roughly correlates to size of company, right? Because obviously, a bigger companies are there because people depend on them so much. And because they're so big, people bet their careers on them. It's not perfectly correlation with company size. But my whole point, if you're following me, right, is that it's much easier to do influence marketing for a church than for a locksmith that makes keys. And so by picking to work for a big or small company, does that actually influence how influential you can be?
No, it's a good question. It's funny. I'm laughing to myself because to be very granular, it only matters where you get your key made if you've had a bad key made.
I have had some bad keys made, but I don't remember where they got them or not.
I'm particular about that. So okay. I think that's the opportunity, right? I mean, in some ways, you nailed it. That's the opportunity of you make something. That's where you differentiate. That's where you make the wedge. Even there, even in that, that lies opportunity. Don't disagree with what you're saying. Like it is easier to talk about the church when everybody's a believer. It is harder work, but not impossible.
Yeah, I definitely as a consultant, I will if anyone wants to be a potential consultant, do not go into a company and imply that their company is more like a key maker or a restaurant than a church, because everybody thinks they're a church. I learned that.
I think that's a great tip for our listeners.
Yeah. I don't know, Matt. Did that make sense? I mean, does that make sense at all?
Yeah. I'm just left thinking that, no one's ever started a crusade because somebody didn't like their favorite restaurant.
Well, there are people protest. People protest restaurants. People.
No, but the order of magnitude that you're representing with those different images makes perfect sense. What I'm trying to think when it comes to influence, I think it will ultimately come down to the interests and size of an audience. So the sort of severity of their interest and the size of it. And those are exponents, if not at least multipliers, of how influential you can ultimately be. Mm-hmm.
Matt, if you keep talking like this, everybody's going to think we're real marketers. You can't keep talking about TAM.
Oh, shit. Did I say it again?
Shh. Yeah.
I'm like thinking, like, can you get people really passionate about things that seemingly are uninteresting? And the answer is yes. Like, still arguments over Pepsi and Coke, probably the same formula, just in different cans.
You treat your audience that you have the best you can and do the best job. I used the metaphor a year or two ago on this podcast. People have a lemonade stand, but they want a steak restaurant. If you have a lemonade stand, you treat your lemonade customers as well as you can, and you make the best damn lemonade you can. And maybe at some point you'll have a steak restaurant. There's a guy in our town that makes chai, and he has like a corner store where he sells candy to the kids, and he makes chai, and he makes it a particular way.
He makes it his way. He won't make it with soy milk. He won't make it decaf. He won't make it non-sugar. He makes a chai, like the way he made it when people were growing up. He's the best key maker. You know, he makes his chai, and he has his audience, and people drive for miles to get his chai. So maybe he's like the master key maker that Amy goes to.
Yeah, no, he's like differentiated. He has something he believes in, and I think when people believe in things, it builds trust. And when you build trust with somebody, you start caring about things you used to not care about.
No, and I think, again, sort of circles full round of, like, in some ways that's the power of influence marketing. Absolutely, there's a scaling question here. One of the questions we had out there that we didn't necessarily fully address. So I think that's a good point of scalability. You know, you scale to the size you've got. And I think one of the cool things about influence marketing is the elasticity when it comes to that. Mm-hmm. That there's a point where you devote the resources, the energy, and even the power of differentiation, like you're saying with the chai guy, that's a great example. Scale it to the market you've got.
Yeah.
We might be marketers. We have to stop meeting like this. We'll give away all the unicorn secrets.
Yeah, somebody has to do it.
I'm going to leave this conversation surprisingly unchanged in my perspective.
That's a human behavior trait.
Isn't that something? I'm gonna leave with exactly what I came in with. But the idea that startups are quirky in the same way and that enterprises are predictable in the same way, I think that's a very nice understanding of the world that perfectly aligns when there's so much variance outside that normalcy based on your role and your activity and the time and place and opportunity in front of you, that I think it's a whole lot messier than we can possibly parse, but that's a great theory we can stick with for now.
Yeah.
It feels like at least we can conclude that we all at least agree that influence is a thing and that you're in charge of your own destiny there, be it whether you're running influence marketing or trying to be an influencer yourself, that the world is in your hands, and we sort of look forward to hearing what your experience is.
Amen to that.
Yeah, yeah. Good stuff.
So a little bit esoteric in our philosophical tonight, but we like to have a debate amongst ourselves and either expose you to it or torture you with it. Depends on your perspective. It's been great sort of having this debate. I'm having new thoughts. I don't know how much my mind has changed either, but I'm definitely going to be thinking about this. So until next time, this has been the Geek Whisperers, and we appreciate you listening.
You've been listening to the Geek Whisperers podcast, where we bring social media and community to enterprise IT. You can listen to all the episodes at our website, geek-whisperers.com, or check us out on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. Your hosts were John Mark Troyer, Amy Lewis, and Matthew Brender, better known on Twitter as J. Troyer, Comms Ninja, and MJ Brender. See you next week. I mean, you have a kind of a low bar for excitement, I think. I mean, it'll be interesting. I'm all for interesting, but I'm not sure we're actually going to get too exciting today.
Fair point, John.